Welcome to a new conversation about software engineering. Today it's me and Heinrich. Heinrich, how are you doing?
Doing great. I'm excited.
End of the year. We are relaxed. And it's a good opportunity to talk about architecture and technology governance. I think a very important topic. We look at it, governance not as hard rules, but rather as an enabler for team autonomy, right? So we want to have team autonomy, but we also want to make sure that everyone runs in the same, that every team runs in the same direction. So therefore, you need some sort of guidance. We see four blocks how you can do governance. Most of the blocks, we already have an episode which we link to. Block number one is architecture principles. So we did an episode 5 years ago with Birgitta Böckeler from ThoughtWorks. The paved road, service template, golden path. We did an episode with Chris Richardson about that one. The architecture advice process, that was the last episode with Andrew Harmel Law, and the technology radar. We have no episode on a technology radar yet. Okay, so since we had all those episodes, what I would do is I would give a brief overview what this governance tool is all about. And then we have a brief discussion about our experiences with it, or what we think, how good or how bad it is. I think it's good to start these days with the paved road, the golden path, because in my opinion, this one has the most potential to get significant improvement with AI assistance. Yeah, famous last words, but I think that's really the one which helps a lot, where AI helps a lot. So I think that's quite interesting. Good. So brief overview, what is actually this thing, paved road service template? Or what is it, and what is the motivation to have it? So basically, a paved road is an orientation for us how to do things. Yeah. So you are in a company and you want to write a new service. You have to think about a lot of things. How do you do, you need a Docker file and customize or Helm. You need a CI, CD pipeline. You need SBOM, vulnerability scanning, policy checks, logging, tracing, metrics, some security stuff like static analysis, dependencies, secret handling. How do you deal with stuff like timeouts or retries, documentation? How do you do remoting, integration with other applications? What's actually your standard folder layout? Do you package by feature? Do you do hexagonal architecture? And more. So there is a lot of stuff you have to think about before you even start. You know, you haven't written one line of code which gives the business any or your company any value. But everyone has to think about those things. And the idea is that companies just provide a template, which is some sort of a dummy application. There is no business logic in it, but it has already everything you need. There is all the things I mentioned. You can even deploy it, you know. It doesn't do anything except hello world, but all the heavy lifting is done. Yeah. What are all the benefits? Well, one thing is obviously time to market, right? So you can start very quickly. It also reduces cognitive load. Not everyone is an expert in all those things. So it's good if you have experts who provide already working code you can use, you know, how to use customize, for example, or how to do secret handling, things like that. not everyone is an infrastructure expert. Also, why we often introduce it additionally is we want to onboard new team members faster. You know, if you say, hey, look at this service template, it's very easy to get a good idea what the whole infrastructure is about. Maybe one last thing. It also helps with alignment and kind of enforcing rules. Enforcing rules may be too hard because it's a template. You can always change it, but it provides excellent defaults. Usually there is always a reason to change it, but not 100%, not 50%, maybe 10 or 20%. You can you change it to what you need, but I think it has usually excellent defaults. Yeah, Heinrich, you wanted to comment on it.
Yeah, I think that's it's a very important vehicle. But like the way you described it is really like it's a kitchen sink, right? In this approach, so you basically put everything you can potentially think of into this, and then you strip it down for the actual application that you need to write. And with like very featureful platforms, I feel like this is kind of getting out of hand very easily, where you just have kind of tons of stuff in there, and then if you release a new feature, or let me kind of get change the service template. And so like, how do you think about this? Do you think in terms of archetypes that you maybe have different kind of application types where you have different templates? And there was a kind of older idea. I think Ruby on Rails has this CLI tool, which allows you to kind of put together a web application relatively fast. So I haven't actually used it, but my understanding is it's kind of a little bit like a toolbox where you can kind of add features to it, like an auth layer or some pages to it with a CLI tool. So I was always like, okay, what does a really compelling kind of golden path a package look like? And such a kind of toolkit to build out like very opinionated company specific applications. For me, that was always like an interesting, maybe endgame-ish thing. So if you are really have a really sophisticated platform, I mean, those days it's likely a chatbot that is the end game. But if like last year, I would probably have said, or 2 years ago, it's like, can we get close to this kind of feeling of I'm putting together larger boxes instead of kind of getting started with a large set of kind of boilerplate.
So I never used the Ruby on Rails. There was something similar in the Java world or in Spring world, Spring Roo. There are also something like JHipster is another tool. It helps a lot with bootstrapping applications, yeah, with the general stuff. So you need a website, you need a database, you need configuration. All those things, those tools help. So a lot, yeah. And so I think that's already a step in the right direction. But what's missing is what is very specific to your company, and also all the, I would say, the infrastructure stuff. Yeah, so they usually have not, they have no pipeline. They have no quality insurance, you know, like code scanning, security scanning. They are opinionated, for example, what you said, standard folder layout, things like that.
Yeah.
So that's good. They also don't have is, if you need it, you know, a very specific thing which is only required in your system. So, for example, I once worked on an integration system in a bank, and basically everything was done with messaging, and we used a specific framework to handle the messages and the post processing of those messages. that is something JHipster or Ruby on Rails cannot provide. They can provide something, but not everything. In that specific case, the company came up with an archetype, with a Maven archetype, I believe. That was at a time I was already gone. I'm not sure if it was a big success, but yeah, it would be an option, I think. So I would say those kind of archetypes are better than the quote unquote normal bootstrapping, because the normal bootstrapping can only do whatever is necessary in your for every application, but not specific to your environment. And another question you had, I believe, was types of applications. I was never in that situation, but I know companies who are, but I never worked on the golden path for those companies. So for example, they say, we have application services, but we also have data products, which are, with a specific data transformation pipeline, and therefore we also offer templating. Yeah. So those are the things I know.
But pragmatically, in practice, this would typically be one repository, kind of a template repository, which is deployable as an independent application, and then you are specializing and kind of molding it your way, right? This is the typical implementation.
Exactly. You check it out, and then you have already working code, and then you put it... You copy it in a new repository, and then you can kind of immediately deploy it. And then you have a running Hello World application, which you can use.
Yeah.
And yeah, I think if you have a microservice environment, that's usually a good idea to onboard new teams, but also onboard new coworkers, because if you have a big service with lots of quote unquote pollution with business logic, it's hard to understand what's the infrastructure code, what are our cross-cutting concerns in a sense of how do we certain things like configuration, also authentication, for example, authorization. Cross-cutting concerns are also part of the templates, and it's easier to onboard in a new team if you can just look at simple code, which shows you the most important the most important parts of your technology choices and architecture. Now.
Yeah, I think it definitely has its place, right? I think I think of it more from an educational perspective than this is kind of a load-bearing stuff in our kind of production pipeline. In the sense of, it's a little bit like copy-pasting code, which is literally involved, right?
Exactly.
It feels a little bit like prototype-based inheritance, where you just start with an object and then start mutating it. So you want to really have no powerful abstractions. So the actual code you have to write is very lightweight. Maybe you have nice libraries or nice APIs that abstract complexity. So you are kind of building more on a platform. But I think working at a large company, there's so much kind of friction and knowledge required to get started and get to know the ecosystem, because there are so many features and so many ways to do it. And having kind of minimal examples for this, just to get started and learn how it's done, there is a tremendous value in having simple examples readily available.
Yeah. So one thing I haven't mentioned, or I briefly mentioned, the cross-cutting concerns. So usually if you have cross-cutting concerns, how do we do logging, metrics, authentication, remote calls, you name it, things which you cannot locate in one package which are in all the places across your code, but it needs to be consistent. You know, you want certain things which cannot be located in one place, they're cross-cutting, you want them consistent. What you do without such a template is you have a documentation and you explain how it should be done and why it is, you know, what were the other options.
Yeah.
So still, I think it's worth to have a documentation which says that's how we do it. And this is actually the rationale behind it. We do this instead of that, right? But here's a link. Just look at the code and it works. You can execute it locally. It's, you know, everything is already there. Yeah. So that's a big advantage. Another thing which I like is, which is, I think, also part of this template, is setting up a local development environment.
Yeah.
You know, you don't have all those descriptions. It's like you check this thing out and then, okay, there are some automation scripts, but everything is already there, right? So you need to read documentation, but you have additionally, I would say, executables which guide the documentation. I think that's a big advantage.
Can we go a little bit of a tangent here?
Sorry?
Can we go a little bit off a tangent here about local environments? Because just one thing I want to mention is in my recent kind of coding, I've been so happy with my local development environments. Like, first of all, like the way UV and Python makes things just very, very easy to set up locally and precisely control. But for a long time, I've been also a big Nix user. And this kind of direnv environments together with a Nix flake, which allows you to kind of your CD into your directory, and you just have a ton of tooling, which is just installed on demand with locked versions, in language independent, and then like secrets injected through env variables through like this env-rc setup. It's grown on me. It's so convenient, and you kind of are relatively machine independent. You just CD into the directory, to just snap, everything is there. And it's like, I don't know, for me, that kind of setup feels extremely smooth. I know I'm probably a little bit outside of mainstream with the Nix usage. I'm not really sure I would recommend that for a big environment, because the edge cases are relatively sharp and it doesn't always work. And kind of bending it your way is a slippery slope. But when it works, the happy path feels great. It feels really nice and slick. Yeah.
Yeah. I'm just thinking of options here, right? You say this is great for you, but in a larger environment, it might be not the best thing. But when I think of optionality in service templates, you know, we had once the case, now we have it again, just as an example. I recommended not to use test containers in my service template. I just said use your database in a normal container inside. You know, every solution has pros and cons. In our template, we just say do it like this, right? Yep. Big problem, right? So a lot of people came, you know, how can you do that? You know, the different camps showed up. And one camp said, that's how we do it anyhow. And the other camp said, we are pissed because, you know, we love test containers. And I said, you can use test containers. It's just not part of this template. But they were pissed anyhow because it was not the standard. And I think this kind of problem you have all the time. You know, we chose to have this template in actually every case where I so I had like three projects where we used the service templates, and it was always Spring Boot based. Yeah. And in one environment, no problem because everyone was doing Spring Boot. There was no other technology. But in the other two environments, or they were very open. You know, they one environment said, we are quite open with the technology people choose, but we start with Spring. And in the other environment, we had already a zoo of technologies. And then the question is, do you offer a template for all the technologies, right? Do you offer a Go template? Do you offer a Node.js template? Do you offer a Clojure template? Well, you can't. I think you can't, because at that time, that's like 5 years ago, I saw a presentation from Netflix. And they said, oh, we only had JVM, our service template, or they call it the paved road. Paved road is only JVM based. And now we try to catch up with Node. And I think they also try to catch up with Go. But even if a company like Netflix in 2020 cannot do it, you know, we were like a 500 people development organization at that time. We just said, okay, we can only offer one technology. Yeah. But I think it's okay if you have, now I think, why decide, right? So if there are two options which you would think they're equally good and you have the time to maintain it, then just do it, you know, just say if you want to use Nix, here is it, because we think it's the best thing, but it's not for everyone. You know, it doesn't scale across the company. Here is another way. So it would work, but the template is a product. It's an internal product. Yeah. You cannot, in the beginning, I just wrote it and I gave it to everyone and then I disappeared. And then I saw, you know, what happened to it. You know, everyone tweaked it, people had better ideas, and it was like, oh shit, you know. If you treat it as an internal product, you need to have some sort of product management, and then it's always a hard decision, you know, what are you offering, what can you maintain.
Yeah, we're getting to the heart of the topic again, which is governance, and that is actually closely related to support. So if you are kind of following the golden path, there should be somebody supporting you. You are doing it the proper way. So the company either has the know-how to do it along those lines and has informal support structures in the way, okay, you can ask the colleagues who have already done it, but they may also have a platform and there may be a kind of sanctioned official way to do things. And there's even a team which is responsible for helping you if you are along that road. So I think, for every engineer, if you have a very specific problem where a specific technology choice gives you a huge upside, you should be able to make that technology choice, but you're also paying the price for it. So I don't know, if you are the only RabbitMQ user and then you have the pleasure to learn MQP and you have the pleasure to operate an Erlang technology bit, and then you may have to become an Erlang expert, but if you are willing to pay the price as a team to say, we are confident that this is the right way, we made the business case for it, go your way. But will there ever be kind of a RabbitMQ template for the company? Very unlikely. So I think Golden Path is, for an organization, a very good way to kind of to mark what is a supported way. So something where you can get help. And the further you are staying away from it, the more unlikely it will be that you get support. And for a platform, I think one of the most important bits for the platform is to draw the boundaries and clearly let the developers understand what is supported functionality, which are supported paths, and which are unsupported paths. And then you can make a choice. Yeah.
So the supported path, I think it's you need to do that, but my experience is also sometimes teams just don't know what it means to choose a technology. You know, they just say that's they can always explain, oh, we are doing AWS Lambda and all those things, right? And we do it with Python and blah 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 because we just like to do it, and then they do it. But then all the problems come, you know, then they are in production and, oh, we need observability. Yeah, well, can't do that for you because it's not the supported way, you know, or you know, all those things. And then they made a decision, but it was not really an informed decision because they are too inexperienced. So I'm not sure how to deal with that. So once we said there is a chief architect and this is the bottleneck. If you want to do something else, you have to go through the bottleneck. You have to talk to this person. Problem is, of course,
it's not good.
You have a bottleneck. But on the other side, it's if you make this decision, it's an informed decision. Now,
I mean, you never thought the chief architect is informed.
Well, I mean, it was not a large organization, right? Yeah. So it was my banking example. They had tiny services, maybe 70 or something, but not too many. It was not like 300 people were working there. It was really tiny services. But that was one idea. I think now, you know, we had in one of the last episodes, the architecture advice process. You could use that one, right? So
that's exactly. I think it brings us to this. Helping teams with decision making is definitely a good idea. And I think the dynamics should be that you have defaults which are articulated and understood, and you deviate from the defaults if you have proper reasons. And what constitutes a proper reason, I think, should be ultimately in the decision making of a team or a developer, because they are in the end on the hook for doing this. Mm-hmm. But how to enable people to do the right decisions and how to also have a leadership structure around it, right? If you have an engineering lead that is technically deep or a principal engineer who is involved, I would expect them to kind of be guides or decision makers here, which are kind of having a little bit of a larger horizon. But I think it's facilitating, enabling more than outsourcing decisions. I think if you are letting other people make these choices, not always sure that it's that you'll get better outcomes. Having like policies and guardrails, having a policy, we are not writing C libraries, so I think I can get behind that. Or like everything is on the JVM, right? Except, or if not, you need a kind of high level business stakeholder to write you an exception. Do it this way, but having a single architect who kind of overlooks everything looks very micromanaging.
I mean I want to say it depends on the company, right? So yeah. But for sure, I mean, we had once a situation, there were 10 teams, which is not too much, I think, you would think 10 teams is not too much for like a lead architect to make a decision, but it is. So you wait for months and it's a disaster, right? So I think it works for smaller environments. So the banking example, I'm not sure how many. I was only there in the bootstrap phase. We were maybe, you know, in the beginning we were 5-6 people, and I think the core team, but then probably overall they had like 25 people. That works, but already 100 or 50, then the bottleneck is not a good idea.
I really never think it's a good pattern. I think you will naturally get into this position if you have a strong technical founder that wrote the first generation of services, that understands the business end to end, and he naturally is the chief architect and he understands this the best, and he's also very quick. But that kind of lasts only so long. Either you become too large or you become too old. But if you have dedicated people who are just architects and just review stuff, they get like they lose touch to technology, the industry, and also to the code base. And it's really tough to make informed decisions if you are not inside the code so much. So you're not actually seeing what the developer sees. And even if it's kind of okay for a few years, maybe, or for a few months, that it will detach, and that the having the doers and the deciders separated, that's never a good dynamic.
Yeah. I mean, the thing is, we have this golden path where we say that's the way how we do it, and the question is, how often does it happen that that you really have to deviate from the golden path in a way that you have to talk to, you know, someone with up the chain? Yeah, I'm not sure how often that happens.
All right, we talked about the golden path, a little bit about ADRs, and we didn't really talk about it, right? The architecture decision process, or design process, or architecture advice process, right?
Exactly. So, I mean, that's our freshest episode. Would you like to proceed with that one, or should we talk about the technology radar first?
I'm not sure I can adequately describe the architecture advice process off the top of my head, but I think since we touched up in it, we should kind of give a little bit of a TLDR.
Do
you feel comfortable in giving that?
Yeah, of course. So the architecture advice process is based on a book Andrew Harmel Law wrote, Facilitating Software Architecture. Highly recommended a reading, but most of you do probably something similar. You know, that's also his experience. So what is this? So the question is, what we discussed a couple of minutes ago, you just want the decisions made from the people who feel the decisions most, right? So you don't want the big architects and an architecture review board where you go with your decisions and those people make a decision for you, although they have no idea about your specific context and your code. So usually this doesn't work out well. I mean, it can work out in smaller organizations, as I said, but usually people are detached from the code. It just doesn't work and you have to wait forever. So what is the alternative? What can you do? So Andrew proposes the architecture advice process. So what does that mean? You have a regular place. It's called the advice forum. It's a place to meet. It's maybe a weekly meeting, for example. And in that meeting, you can seek advice from other people. So who are the people who are in that meeting? Usually people who have knowledge about the decision you want to make. So if you want, as a team, you want to make a decision, you have to find out who are the people in my company who have specific knowledge in this. Yeah. For example, I'm not very good in security topics. So whenever I have to make a security decision, I try to gather as much as possible security experts. That's maybe a bit broad, but people who know the topic, right? But also what you need are the affected stakeholders, usually people from within your team, but also, you know, sometimes you have to make a decision which affects also people outside your team. They should also know about it. Very important. You know, you cannot just make a decision and ignore affected people outside your team. And then you go, you have all those people, and I mean, you have to organize this meeting. As I said, it can be a weekly place where people can subscribe to, and you go there and you have an artifact, which is the architecture decision record. So that is the shared decision-making document. So the architecture decision maker, architecture decision record is, it can be a markdown file or a Confluence page which describes the problem. In short, you know, what's the problem? What are the options you can think of? And eventually, what is the decision also other things you can put in additionally, this, you know, all the stakeholders which are affected, what are the priorities you weight the decisions on, the options, you know, options have pros and cons, but it depends on your on your priorities, how to weight those pros and cons. And that's basically the document you work on, right? So the you seek advice from people who have knowledge, and they can bring in their expertise. They can say, you missed this option, or this option you're describing is not perfect. It's not 100% right. You missed this downside or this upside. And basically, you know, when you do that, and I can highly recommend it. We didn't do it exactly like Andrew did it, but generally, if you go public with your decision, it's usually a much better decision because you're forced to have this document. This document, the ADR, is also better written if you go to an advice forum, because, you know, there are people who have sometimes no idea on what you are working, domain specific. And if they read it, they can say, I just don't understand what you're saying. You know, it's only, you know, maybe you and your team understand it, but, or it's too long, it's too short. And in the end, you have really a nice document, a clear document with all the options, and you can make an informed decision. Yeah. So I think one thing which Andrew says, it's you seek advice. You know, you can get the advice, but you can ignore the advice.
Yeah, that's really good.
So I think, but you say it's really good, but it hurts for people who give advice, I must say. Because I often give advice, and I think you really shouldn't do it. You know, I say, you know, you just use, we have an internal service. You don't have to buy it. You don't have to develop it, for example. But then people do it anyhow. And I think, why? You know, not invented here syndrome. Or I had this case once, you know, I knew that they wanted to use a certain technology. And it just doesn't matter what comes out of the advice process. They just are interested in this technology because it's resume-driven design, kind of, right?
I mean, the dynamic is...
It has downsides.
So the problem is, I think, if you are giving directions in part of this review process, that A, you are reintroducing this kind of architect role who may be decoupled from the consequences of the decision, and B, you are incentivizing people to just swipe it under the rug. There's a lot of things which don't need to be necessarily documented or on the surface. They will just happen. They will be checked in, they will be deployed, and it's just then it's that way. And then half a year later, people realize, oh, we are doing it this way. Yeah, sure, this is how it's been. So that is worse because there's no transparency.
Mm.
And I think having this incentive to be very having the ability to be transparent and getting as a developer positive return of investment. If you are already sold on this is the technology to go to, I mean, you at least want to know, did I overlook something, right? Is there something that I'm not aware of? And so you can get it from this process without feeling your autonomy being taken away. I think that dynamic is positive. So in the end, you end up with a process where you heard the arguments, and you as a stakeholder, your voice is also on the record, and you can enable this learning process. So I think this kind of cycle, okay, I'm resume driven, or I'm kind of victim of the technology hype cycle, that is something that's also related to seniority. And you should kind of within a team have like enough voices of reason. But ultimately, I mean, what do you want to do?
Yeah, true. I mean, you said something very good, which was you make at least an informed decision and you know that there is no catastrophic downside. Because that was exactly the case we had. There were some advice givers who were extremely negative about this technology choice. And they came up with lots of reasons why this, you know, brings the whole development organization to a standstill, which is valid. You know, you can say that. You can say it's because this and that and this and that. We write that in the architecture decision record. We believe that the following disaster will happen.
Yeah.
And it was quite a junior team. So I said, okay, let's pick those parts and try to get an answer. You know, is this really true? Because if, imagine some very important person asks you why you still made the decision, although those people said you shouldn't and you have no answer. You know, they say the following disaster will happen and then the disaster happens. Then you need, you cannot just say, we just didn't feel to to use another technology or to, you know, to, we just failed to ignore the advice. You have to have a good answer. So we spent a lot of time finding good answers, solid answers to those questions. And I must admit, although I wasn't very happy with the technology choice, so far, 3 years, we are 3 years in now, or 4 years in almost, no disaster. You know, some small problems, but no disaster. So, I think especially if you have very critical decisions, it's good to go out.
Yeah, for sure. For sure. If you cannot really foresee all the consequences, and if this is a like thing that a lot of people will integrate against or care about, then this is, it's very critical. And the upsides of getting this right are also huge. I mean, if you have a central component that is well architected, that can mean a whole lot for in, like speed of development down the line.
Yeah.
But yeah. I mean, it's the social technical systems thing, right? So it's not about getting the technical decisions right. This is not what makes successful like products or companies. It's having everybody on the same page, pulling into the same direction with functional processes that converge to positive outcomes. So you have to allow people to make mistakes. You have to give people enough motivation and agencies. You have to think about a collaboration model much more than about getting the decisions right.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, actually, at that company, when I started there, at that client, so I did a whole lot of stakeholder interviews. And and then I would say almost every team said, yeah, you know, now they are telling us we are autonomous. They tell us this autonomy for a long time.
Yeah.
But we are allowed to make our own decisions. But if the decisions are not of the taste of, you know, some more important people, then they just overrule the decision. So, you know, whatever. So that's also the thing, right? So if you want autonomy, you have to swallow this frog. You have to say, okay, it's kind of, you could even say we are not talking yet about architecture principles, but it could be a principle, architecture or leader principle, that teams make their own decision no matter what. You know, no one intervenes. It's the team's decision and the team's responsibility.
Yeah, I think at a very large, you need some form of higher governance, how you want to do integrations, how your data flows are going to look like
at the
higher sense. And then it's the art is kind of cutting out boxes which have enough autonomy for meaningful, also localizing solutions, right? You don't want to, like, you don't want to live in communism where you everything kind of is kind of architected from the top. You want to federate this decision making and federate the architecting, and so that's the art. I mean, I wouldn't say I'm super knowledgeable about it, but I think on a high level you need both. You need kind of people who understand the end to end, but you need to enable the teams to move with as much autonomy as possible. And that's critical for speed and also for motivation. And to balance this, I think that's the quality of a great CTO.
Yeah, I mean, that also brings us to other governance tools. So if you have the advice process, I mean, I'm saying you make your own local decision, but of course, in your, let's say, in the advice process, but there is, of course, you have guardrails usually. I mean, one guardrail is you have to go public, right? So you have to go public in a sense that you have to be in this advice forum, but there are other guardrails. So one guardrail is you have the service template, golden path, paved road, however you want to call it, you know, that gives you already some orientation. If you have good reasons, you can deviate from it, but there is also there are also architecture principles. There is also technology radar. I just say technology radar, but you know, technology choices you can do.
Yeah.
And something we haven't talked, which I didn't list today, but it's something which is probably very InnoQ specific, is called a macro architecture. So what is a macro architecture, or what are architecture principles? So they're kind of similar, I would say. So an architecture principle is a high level statement that describes how you want your system to behave and grow. Yeah. Just have a few examples here, you know, from companies I work with, data is a shared asset, for example, you know, it usually has a catchy title, yeah, or we have autonomous cross-functional teams. We want to minimize technology variation. You build it, you run it, even is a delivery principle, yeah, or which is always to a lot of pain is like the company good is higher than the team good is higher than the individual good, which is very often, of course, ignored because we make locally optimized decisions. But still, you have those principles, and those principles, they come, you have company goals. From those company goals, you derive architecture requirements. From those architecture requirements, you derive principles like those. And then if you make a decision, you can always orient the decision process on those principles, right? So simple example, you know, our goal is we are a bank and we want to be in all kinds of countries. We have a banking product and we want to sell it to all kinds of countries. The problem is banking is heavily regulated. So we don't know all the regulations. So you could have a principle which just says we don't use cloud provider specific technology, right? That's a principle. You can make a decision, you know, if you want to use Kafka, well, you can, but you can use Kafka. You could even use Kafka on AWS. If you go to China and there is no Kafka on AWS, well, then it's not too hard to have another solution. But if you decide to use SNS from AWS and then you go to China and there is no SNS, then it's probably more expensive to change something, just as an example. So that is, I think those principles, they help to make consistent decisions across teams, also align choices with business strategy. You know, whenever someone asks me, why did you do this decision? I always have the traceability. I can also always say, well, this decision orients itself at the principle, and the principle is part of this requirement, and the requirement is part of the organizational goal, right? So that usually that helps, yeah. And also it reduces debate, because we have some sort of shared decision framework, which I like, yeah. However, I think it's very hard to come up with those principles. I was always failing, and then I looked what are other companies doing. I think Zalando also has architecture and decision delivery principles, which are publicly available. Yeah, exactly. Now you make this maybe, so you don't know. And that's the problem I also experience. You know, you come up with all those principles, you know, you have this catchy title, you have a short description, you have a longer description, you know, but nobody knows about it.
I mean, I think there are many overlapping things which are like resonating with principle. Like on the one hand, it's kind of guardrails, which are really easy. Like you are not writing in Rust, or you are multi-cloud. Okay. Well, that's just like a guardrail or a constraint that is really strict. And then there is this kind of very soft or kind of goal-oriented things like Dry or you build it, you run it maybe in some sense. But for example, it's maybe like tenants. So what do you value more? Maintainability or performance? And so like one organizing principle is like we are here to sell socks. So we don't optimize for performance before we optimize for the product. And so this is for me, I think, a principle, like how we value, like every software system has like 100 different optimizations directions. And to have a sorting of those directions, so if you make decisions, what you should be your priority? Do you kind of, how much speed do you want to have? How does observability or operability rank with regards to, I don't know, maintainability, product velocity, coherence? I don't know, like a lot of different attributes that you are desirable properties of a system, right? And so, yeah, I think those work different, and those are important, and those are documented to varying degrees. And for example, when we built our observability SDKs at Zalando, which is actually a set of libraries that is evolved with a larger community, we spent quite some time to specify this ranking of like how important is performance when building this, how important is least, are we allowed to throw exceptions ever from observability code or not, right? How simple should these things be to use versus how transparently are we allowing people to use OTel native APIs?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I want to come back to your maybe we have those principles in a smaller organization. So just say we have 100 developers, I would say. Yeah. It's or even less. Then it's easy to come up with those principles because it's easy to communicate. But I'm working, for example, with a company, they have 3,000 people in the IT, in their digital department, however you want to call it. It requires really a communication campaign, because people know, those things exist, like 20 other things exist, and you know, how should I know? and why should I care? I think it's hard to communicate. If you look at most of those, when I look at Zalando or Scout24, you know, there are a couple of companies who make them public. They have lots of those principles, of those guiding principles. And in the episode with Birgitta, She said, yeah, you should actually start really small, right? So you don't have dozens, maybe have five to start with, maybe even three.
Yeah.
And that feels something like you can do, even if it hurts, that you think we need more. Probably you don't, right? So because if you have 10, nobody knows the 10, but if you have 3, you have a good chance that people at least know 3, and those are the architecture guidance, which is the most important one. And what we once had was, at some point, which is maybe 2 years, you're 2 years in, some architecture principles are kind of institutionalized. You know, nobody really thinks about it anymore. So if you start at this company, then nobody, you just cannot do anything else than principle 1, 2, or 3. You know, just give an example. You build it, you run it. Back then, you know, it's like 10 years ago, yeah, it was a big thing. And now, I mean, no, now nobody thinks about it anymore. You know, if it's like the...
Yep. The version control.
It's like version control. You don't have to mention it. Yeah. Now you can introduce other things, right? They had also like a mobile first or API first. It's version control exactly. And then you can come up with new ones. Yeah, maybe one thing, because there is this thing called the Amazon leadership principles. I don't know if you heard about those. People usually laugh about them. You know, it's like, this is only bullshit, and I don't know, right? Because they are so simple, they are so obvious. But I think, they are obvious, but on the other side, they are now explicit, right? So no, everybody knows what's everybody knows what's important and what's not important. All right, maybe take another 10 minutes on the technology radar. I must admit, I'm on very thin ice. It's time to make a full episode on this one. So the technology radar has been popularized by ThoughtWorks 15 years ago. So the technology radar is a lightweight visual tool that shows which technologies, tools, practices, you name it, you know, it's up to you. An organization is evaluating, adopting, holding, or phasing out. Yeah? ThoughtWorks, for example, they have an adopt ring. You know, if your context is appropriate, you should seriously consider this technology. It's proven and mature to use. And the other side, there is something like hold. You know, don't use it.
Don't
we
use
have it,
it
but. Forget about it. A trial is something like ready to use, but not proven. And assess is, yeah, that's interesting stuff, but do not try yet, yeah, except you have a really good case. Yeah. And they have in their radar, which comes out, I think, 4 times a year or 2 times a year, they have 4 quadrants: techniques, tools, platforms, languages, and frameworks. But you're really you're free. You know, I think Zalando has other quadrants. It really depends on you. How can it help with architecture governance? To be honest, I don't know. I know theoretically. I can say I also tried it, but it was not very successful. I can talk about it. But the idea is it should create a shared guidance without rigid standards, you know, align teams on preferred and discourage technologies, for example, you know, support decision making. But it also encouraged innovation while managing risks. Yeah. And it reduces the fragmentation of technology across projects. I think that's the most important parts.
Yeah, I can talk to this a little bit. I look at the ThoughtWorks tech radar a little bit like the Gartner quadrant. It's kind of a, it's a opinionated kind of perspective on kind of where different technologies are in terms of hype and maturity and how seriously to take them. But I think there's a large part of marketing here, and like just having something to continuously talk about. I mean, it's interesting, but it's a data point like the Gartner quadrant is, but I think there's a lot of kind of market forces putting on this, and it has a different role. Zalando is, I don't know how many other companies have implemented a tech radar or a tech radar process, but I think it's for large organizations, it's an interesting way to solve the problem of kind of technical diversity. And I mean, I was having the ops eyes on, but this is, I think, maintainability and operations go hand in hand here. So the basic problem is if you have too many different technologies, you don't have the operational know-how. You run into problems with scaling or with keeping things alive or just with know-how of your developers. And some of those technologies require deep knowledge, like Apache Flink, for example. Yeah, you just don't set it just up and it kind of runs. You have to know your way around, have your kind of network and the developer community, ideally, or Postgres, right? So you have certain technologies where you have sufficient knowledge inside the company to really run them well and build on top of them well, and ideally kind of evolve the product in a way that helps you as or continues to support your use cases. So that's the ideal case, right? And there's something you have in the middle. And the tech radar can be leveraged in a way that it's kind of a process that is helping you with this form of governance. And it can be soft, but it can be also pretty hard in the sense that you are not using any technology that is not in the tech radar, period. You may do a prototype or kind of a time-scoped experiment with a technology that's not there. But if you want to use it, you have to pitch it for adopt. And or to assess, so you have to get it onto the radar, and there's a process for this. You need a champion that is stewarding the technology. You need internal support challenges. You need documentation. So there's kind of a bar the technology has to meet, and there's a process with, in this case, all the principal engineers around it who are making those decisions, which kind of moves on and which kind of stuff is phased out or voted out. And it's a source of friction, because if you think this is great and we should really doing it that way, it takes a lot of kind of politics and words to convince enough peers to get it on there. But it's also a great, really great way to stop a lot of discussions that are just, okay, here I'm resume driven or I'm hype driven, because you always have this place in it. And for Zalando, what's very interesting is the public engineering branding. I think a lot of people know Zalando as a tech organization through the radar. I think it's even more popular than the blog, the engineering blog. So I think more people look at the radar if they are just assessing technologies to kind of get Zalando perspective on it, then maybe read our tech blog, right? So from this perspective, I think it's interesting. I think it's for very large organizations, and there are a lot of ways to hold it. And I think I'm not really sure that anyone is right or like how to exactly do it, but I think there's value there.
Yeah, I mean, you mentioned something which we did certainly wrong, because ThoughtWorks, they have this thing, build your own radar, and there is software, and you can just set up your own radar, and then you can make pull requests for if you want to introduce. If you want to use a new technology or, you know, assess a new technology.
Yeah.
But the problem is if you don't set a bar, you know, I think Financial Times, for example, Sarah Wells, she says at the Financial Times, you need to write a two-pager, you know, for every technology you want to pitch. Yeah. The problem you have and how this technology will help you, what are the costs, what are the alternatives, and all those things. And they say if you are not willing to write a two-pager and answer a couple of mandatory questions, then this pull request is just, you know, it will just be ignored, right? So because that was our problem. We were just flooded by ideas. And then you're like, I just cannot even, you know, the ideas after ideas after ideas, you know, what is this technology for? I don't know, you know, what can I do? It was actually, we were a bit of stupid, to be honest.
I mean, it's a learning experience.
Yeah.
But at least it's adopted, right? So the default is you launch something new and nothing happens. And nobody cares.
So exactly.
It's a first step. Yeah.
You end up and you see, oh, there are Clojure services and only two people can program in Clojure.
Now, let me say, I think AI is changing a lot of the dynamics here. For example, like shell scripting, I'm doing a lot of shell script in Ruby these days. I cannot do Ruby. I've never learned Ruby, but I feel like it's looking a lot nicer than shell and then Python as well. I just like the aesthetics of it. I like reading it a lot.
Mm-hmm.
And I also, for the first time, I understood the lineage of the name, right? So you have shell, then you have Perl as kind of a mix between bash and awk from the lineage. And then Ruby is kind of object-oriented Perl with nice syntax. And it's like, okay, it was made for this. And so your vibe code stuff in Ruby, I don't know. I think for shell scripts is largely fine. But I think language wise, the dynamics of how much knowledge do I need, how costly is it to switch to a different language, this is shifting fast. So I also think the kind of truth about governance, in the sense of this is how strict I need to be in an organization of that size to be fast and effective. This is how much kind of many technologies I can use. This is changing quickly. And also for a developer, and how many technologies do I need to be deep? I feel a lot freer to use a lot more different languages because I don't no longer kind of have to type them up and need to know the libraries. I need to know kind of what the high level library ecosystem looks like, what the engine can do, the runtime can do well, how packageable it is. Like Python is so nice for shell script, but then you cannot deploy it anywhere because nobody has figured out how to deploy Python. It never works. And so it's like, let me write Go. And then the deployment is fine. And usually it's like, no, it's not going to happen because I cannot write Go good enough to do that in a productive way. Well, if it doesn't just needs to be okay and it's not so large, well, just do it in Go. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, true. I really wonder how that unfolds. I mean, for me, it's the same. I'm less, I do not do so much production code these days, actually none.
Yeah.
But trying something new is so, the bar is now very low.
Yeah.
You know, it's great actually. And, but still, I must say, I mentioned Clojure. Clojure or Lisp, they are probably, you know, there are languages which are easier to adopt, I would say.
The problem
for
with
me,
Lisp,
at least.
The reading of Lisp is extremely unnatural. And I have a blog post, an infamous blog post, was hated on Hacker News, but it was called The Problem with Lisp. And I was arguing that you never know if it's a function call or a macro, which is the core problem. Because like as a mathematician, I kind of know how to parse a formula like inside out. And it looks like this is the same thing in Lisp, but it's not, because you have all the special forms, which kind of you have to know that this evaluation, this one changes the evaluation order or just a transformation on the things. So you have to kind of parse outside in and inside out at the same time. And then it's also crazy functional land. So there are so many quirks that you kind of have to kind of get through in order to be able to read it. While it's actually, from the interpreter perspective, it's almost exactly Python. There's nothing special about it. There are so many things that are it looks very functional, but you can set variables, you can have side effects. This is like, it's all perfectly possible. enclosure in all the Lisp variants, most of them. So it's not, there's, you can write exactly the same code in Python and in Lisp, but just like the syntax is so horrible, or it's so different. And I think it's kind of a pity. Maybe, I don't know if there's a really better way, but I think for a lot of use cases, specifically shell scripting, little tasks would actually be a good language, but yeah, not going to happen.
Yeah, reminds me, Rich Hickey, most successful episodes, case podcast episodes with, I don't know, 20,000 downloads or something. All right.
On which topic?
I think it was problem solving.
Ah, okay. You
know, yeah, it was, I forgot the English terms, but he said a few very nice things on how to solve problems, right? You know, lying on the couch, have enough time for deep thinking.
Yeah. Yeah, that helps. Going for a walk.
Exactly. I think Hancock-driven development, that's how he called it. Is it? Yeah. All right. Yeah, thank you so much. Actually, I want to split it in two episodes. Now it's one. Maybe, yeah, let's see what we can do. But
I think we can do one.
Yeah. We have all the four. I forgot about the macro architecture, but yeah.
Next time,
exactly. All right. So thank you for everyone who made it so far. And yeah.
See you Happy around, New Year. We are recording this 19th of December. I don't know when it will be released, but I hope you had a good New Year's.
Exactly. Cheers. Bye-bye.